everybody. My name's Deborah. I'm an alcoholic.
Deborah.
Oh, I keep wanting to say I'm a recovered alcoholic because I have recovered from that hopeless state of mind and body I came here with on April 3rd, 1987 was my last drink. Came to AA about a week later. But I did not drink during that time. Whoops, I keep losing my stuff. Anyway. So I hope in the last couple of weeks I've made it clear that I am a real alcoholic. I started drinking when I was 14 years old, and by the time I came in here around 29, age 29, and came to AA, and I came here because my life was unmanageable, and I was powerless over alcohol. I couldn't control it. I couldn't control it once I started, and I couldn't control whether I was going to drink or not. And I was, I guess, fortunate in the sense that I hit car accidents when I drank. And now I can kind of laugh about it. I mean, thankfully I can, because I did not kill anyone. And that is only by the grace of God, you know. But the thing of it was that the consequences just became too much to bear, and that's what brought me to my first AA meeting. Let's see here. I always like to I work the steps when I sponsor people from the big book, because this is our instruction manual. So when I came to AA in 1987, and I heard that I was powerless over alcohol, as I said before in step one. I could readily accept it. And my life definitely felt unmanageable to me. The things that were going on, you know, with the blackouts, oh my goodness. It just is, it's terrifying, really. I had no problem with that. Where it got harder for me was in step two and three. I came to believe that power greater than myself would restore me to sanity. I did not know how insane I was. I don't think I had a full awareness of that until, you know, 20 years or something. And I've told you already that I was foggy on God, or higher power. And in the beginning, and for the first 17 years of my sobriety, I was really, this is my program. I was working the Don't Drink and Go to Meetings program and the Fake It Till You Make It program. Because I did not think I had a relationship or connection with God. And, you know, I know this may sound very strange to you. I have a hard time. I've really been thinking about it the last few days. What did I do? What was my experience? I alluded to the fact that, you know, I've told you I got sober in Pittsburgh. I was following the program as it was being handed out at AA beginners meetings. Those were the instructions I was following. I was reading the big book at home. I was going to meeting just about every day. was listening so carefully, trying to see, if, you know, I think I was trying to understand God. I've since come to know that that is not possible. What I really was needing was a faith in God, a faith in a higher power, which I really did not have. And I guess what I was doing was what everybody else was doing. You know, I had this, always had this very big thing with feeling very self-conscious, feeling like I really didn't fit in, that other people were better than me, that I was not as good as you. And always. And so, you know, being new in sobriety, I wanted to fit in with the other alcoholics. And, you know, I know, right? That's how insane I was. I thought this was Well Persons Anonymous, okay? I really did. And if you think that, you might be in for as long a rocky ride as I've been on, because it ain't Well Persons Anonymous. I hung on the words of people that I just knew were better than me, and that, you know, they were sages in wisdom at 5 years sobriety. And nobody was talking about God at those meetings. People were, I was very confused by the God topics, as I said, you know, I just did the fake it till you make it. And when it came to step three, made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood Him. What that meant to me was that I needed to do the third step prayer with my sponsor, which I did. And for me, the third step the third step was my commitment to go on with the rest of the steps. It had very little to do with God at all, except that I continued to ask for God to keep me sober in the morning. I thanked Him at night, but all during the rest of the time, I was the master of my own ship, the captain of my own ship. Saying turn your will and your life over, what does that mean? What does that even mean? I really did not know. And the thing of it is, and going to meetings and just hearing people say, oh, turn it over. I'm like, turn what over? You know, I did not know what people were talking about, really. I was not present. I wasn't getting it, I guess is what I'll say. I wasn't getting it. I just want to read from our big book, page 60, which is out of chapter 5, How It Works. It says, our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear through pertinent ideas, A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives, B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. C, that God could and would if He were sought. Being convinced we were at step three, which is that we decided to turn our will and our life over to God as we understood Him, just what do we mean by that and what do we do? Well, I read all the stories, the talk in here about self-will and self-centeredness. And I did not think that was me. I didn't think that was me. They talked about the actor and trying to, you know, control the show and the people and the this and the that, and, you know, what happens if it doesn't go right. He exerts himself even more. And it says here, is he not a victim of the delusion? He can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if he only manages well. That's pretty much, to me, it is delusional thinking. And I was guilty of it. And thinking that, you know, my self-will, I could manage it, that if I wanted whatever, it was up to me to get it. And it says here, selfishness, self-centeredness, this we think is the root of our troubles, driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. We step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us seemingly without provocation, but we invariably find that at some time in the past we've made a decision based on self, which later placed us in a position to be hurt. So our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. They arise out of ourselves, and the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot, even though he usually doesn't think so. Or she. Above everything, we alcoholics must get rid of this selfishness. We must, or it kills us. And God makes that possible. Now, as I said to you, I did not think I was selfish. I didn't think I was self-centered. You know, I thought I was. If you would have told me, you know, I heard people talking about self-pity or being a victim or any of those things, and I was very much not thinking I was that. But I am willing at this point of my life, at 32 years of sobriety, to say I was filled with self-pity. I was, and I thought I was a victim. And of circumstances. You know, if you grew up in a household the way I grew up in, you would feel the same way I do, or you would have the same problems I do. And I was just very ashamed of all of that. And I didn't really want anybody to know. For a long time, well into my adulthood, well into my sobriety. And, you know, we're only as sick as our secrets, right? I mean, I've heard this at meetings before. So I've since come to understand what does it mean to turn your will and your life over. Your will is, I've been told, your life, your thinking. And your will is everything else. And that is what, you know, the founders are talking about. Your will, your thinking, and your life. I mean, the thing of it is, for me, it's a very hard thing to do when you're addicted. I was addicted to my own thinking. The thoughts, the racing all the time, and the thinking about this, and the worrying about that. And, you know, is this going to, you know, everything. And it was always like that. I couldn't turn it off. I didn't know anything else. But I've since come to find out That is part of the disease of alcoholism. That delusional, insane, crazy, obsessive thinking. And that was me. That was me. And I do want to say, in our book, it talks a little bit about it, but here on the grapevine, March 2020, there's a special section, an article in here on emotional sobriety, which I remember. This was again around 17 years of sobriety in the grapevine. They published the article that Bill Wilson wrote for the grapevine on that topic in the 1950s. It was very intriguing to me because that's what I wanted. I wanted to have emotional sobriety. I just didn't know how to get it. For me, my feelings, my emotions, that was the most important thing. That was it. I made decisions in my life based on my feelings. And man, I've since learned it's not a good way to make a decision. Especially as an adult. Bill Wilson wrote in that article that emotional sobriety is the next frontier in sobriety, that we alcoholics have unhealthy dependencies. You know, the alcohol, the drinking of the alcohol is the ante in the poker game for us, really. That's what gets us a seat in here. Thank God for alcohol. I'd still be out there. You know, and I certainly didn't understand the magnitude of step two, the insanity that is talked about in step two, or anything like that, until I hit an emotional bottom at 17 years sober. This disease is so cunning, baffling, and powerful. You know, the drinking is but a beginning. And that has been the case for me. It's another interesting thing here that, and I've talked about this a little bit, you know, I getting sober on the fellowship. And that's how my sponsor got sober, through the working of the program in the fellowship, as opposed to the book. You do the program in the fellowship, and you go home and you read the book, and somehow I told myself, it all matched up. That is unreal. Unreal. Hello. So.
It's not going, it's fire. It's God calling.
Oh, good. I need to talk to him. So, anyway, at 17 years, I mentioned that I was homicidal, suicidal, and I got hooked up with this woman. Her name was Yolanda. And she actually has the same amount of sobriety I do. She was much more emotionally mature and had a very strong service history, her own personal, and working the steps, carrying the message. I mean, she was just devoted to it. And I cannot, you know, God put her in my life. I know that now. Because I was in so much pain at that time. You know, God works through people. You know, he doesn't come down here. I wanted to have a spiritual experience in the worst way. I just kept hoping I would. But that's not how it was for me. But I did meet this little Mexican lady, Yolanda, at 17 years sober, and we went through the steps from the beginning. And that's where I, you know, like I said last week, it was just a light began to shine. And because I was just, my way wasn't working, even in sobriety. It wasn't. I was not happy. I was not emotionally sound at that time. But I looked good on the outside. You know what I mean? I looked good. I had a good job, you know, car, house, all the things. And that is, I guess, you know, those were the worldly clamors that I was chasing. The relationship, the this, the that, and, you know, none of it worked for me. None of it worked. And there I was in San Antonio with Yolanda. We redid the third step. And, you know, I had to, it has been a long haul for me. It has been a long haul, especially changing my thinking. And, you know, I'm powerless over that, too, by the way. I am. I'm powerless over that. And it took me, you know, many years, the last 10, 12 years of, you know, increasing my contact with God. Thy will be done. I mean, the things still come up in my head. The voices, they're still there. You know what I'm saying? They're still there. Now, those are the ones I'm aware of, you know, not to mention the other secret committee that's meeting without my permission down in the... That is a whole nother thing. But anyway... learning to, you know, I just have to, it's just too, I can just sink down so fast in negative thinking. And so I've done everything. I've listened to preachers on CDs and tapes and this and that. And, you know, I love right now our culture of Zoom. I love Zoom. I love that we can listen to AA meetings on Zoom. We can hop on a Zoom meeting. We can listen to leads on Zoom. There are just so many ways that I can get my thoughts off on a higher plane than where they want to be. And so anyway, I think I'm getting better. I think I've finally gotten a little better with all that. In fact, I know I have. And one of the biggest reasons I can tell you that, and I mentioned to you, I got married this summer for the first time. Age 61. And if that is not like really just a prime example of selfishness and self-centeredness, I do not know what else is. You know what I mean? I was not capable of, making that kind of a commitment and wanting to honor another person because I was too busy worrying about me and in my head all the time. So I just want to say how forever grateful I am to God, putting Dan in my life, putting you all in my life. When I came into AA, I do want to say, and for many, many years afterwards, I did not have gratitude. I did not have gratitude either, whatever. What a stupid topic, that's what I would say. What? Grateful for what? Oh, there are just so many problems, you know? And my job to solve them all. What was I thought? First thought wrong, right? So anyway, next month is Gratitude Month, and I'm going to just start a little early because I had to... This program for me was work. I had to make a decision in step three to change my thinking, to change my mind, and seek God. And I have. I did that, and I have. And, you know, I'm grateful. I was a seeker. I still am a seeker for any kind of, any kind of natural beauty or kindness or anything that crosses my path. It just delights me. I'm trying, you know, this summer was so great with the hummingbirds at my theater, and I kind of miss them, but I know I'll see them again in the spring, God willing, you know. But those are the delights of my heart. I just feel like God sends them to me, and it's they're just so delightful. And I'm grateful even for the things I used to complain about. And that was one of the things that Yolanda, it was like this law of attraction thing. The more I complained and bemoaned my lot in life, the more negative I received. The more gratitude and positivity I put out there in the universe, the more I received positive. And so, what I'm saying is that even in the face of a catastrophe, losing your job, going bankrupt, breakups, all of that, all those things, I have been through them all, saying, thank you, God, for answered prayer. And what I mean by that is that there will be some good that comes out of it. There will be. I know that now. In the beginning, you don't know that. You think, oh my God, what am I going to do? Lost my job, I'm banging, whatever. And, you know, running around, scrambling here, scrambling there, I've got to get a new job, blah, blah, blah. And the advantage of now having 32 years of sobriety is that I now have experience in these areas, and I can say, this is what the old-timers used to say to me, don't worry about it, it's going to work out. Ah, what? You know, how can you say that? Over and over. But you know what? They were right. It works out. Things work out. And it's not the way I would have thought, or even the way maybe I would have wanted. But it, you know, this is for me what it means to be living in God's will. You know, I'm not trying to be in charge of that anymore. Accepting, that's the other part of the Serenity Prayer, right? You know, accepting things as they are. That is, I want them to be. And so, in our book, it says, first of all, we have to quit playing God. Next, we decided that hereafter in this drama of life, God is going to be our director. He is the principal. We are his agents. Most good ideas are simple, and this concept was the keystone of the new and triumphant arch through which we pass to freedom. And, keystone, I have since learned, is an actual structure or a rock or a something in the foundation of a building that gives it its stability with the rest of the structure. And, that's what third step is for us, the keystone. And I would just like to close, if you don't mind, with all of us doing the third step prayer, if you haven't done it in a while or if you need a refresher. It's a good prayer. Okay, you ready? May God, I offer myself to thee, to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. And take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help, of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. Amen. And thank you all very much. Okay.
Thank you, Deborah.
Yeah.
So now we will open this up to anybody that has any questions for our speaker. Mm. We've got Bruce here in the room to start us off.
Bruce is in the house.
Thanks, Deborah. That was very intriguing and enlightening to me to hear it. I had trouble with the third step and the word insanity. And it wasn't till probably after 2 years sober when I went to a meeting one day on a Saturday. And I spoke the truth and I said, if this is as good as it gets, I might as well be drinking. And I don't even know what the topic was, but it came out and I went home and somebody cared enough that they knew me and they knew my sponsor and suggested that maybe he should talk to me because he wasn't doing too well on Saturday. So he did, and he made it so easy just by, he said, how would you like to just start over? I was like, can you do that? He said, yeah, we'll just hit the easy button, we're starting over. So that's what we did, and that first 2 years, I was on a pink cloud. I was doing a lot of social stuff, wearing a funny red wig and drinking syrup, with Santa.
Yikes!
So, but it all, when the work started to get more, I just wasn't doing the work. So, I didn't get that until maybe it was 3 years when I realized that when I was digging and doing my homework and looking at myself, you were a crazy truck. That is the definition of temporary insanity for me. So somebody's trying to come out of the computer. But anyway,
I'm being communicated from the other side.
I do owe you a debt of gratitude, which I always remember how you helped me. You became an angel in my life when I needed it the most to help deal with my mother. Mm. And you were there, and it couldn't have orchestrated it any better. And I'll be forever grateful for your help there. That was a big deal. But the question I have is, when did you realize that you were had some temporary insanity? Because you said you had did you have an aha moment, or did you just start doing work, or?
Well, I think it was that, for me, I don't think I fully understood the impact of step two until I hit my bottom at 17 years sobriety. You're a lot quicker than I am. It took me, I was a hard-driving self-will person, self-will-reliant person. And the insanity of the way I thought the world should be was insane, because it wasn't. and neither was I. I was not right, because my ideas weren't working. My way was not working. And, you know, it is an interesting statistic. It's, I don't know how old it is, but somewhere it is said that less than 0.5% of alcoholics achieve long-term sobriety, which is, you know, 20 years or greater. Less than 0.5%, which over the years sounds probably and sadly about right. This shit is hard. This is hard work. And then you go through the desert time. You say, is this it? I'm sober? This sucks. Or, you know, whatever it is. I already knew that I was struggling, but what I didn't know was that was part of the insanity. That's alcoholic thinking. That's the way alcoholics are. We're hardwired that way. I guess I felt guilty about it because I felt like I should be better. But I had no control over it. And you know what I mean? I'm powerless over that. But now I know. Now I know. And so I don't like living like that. I don't like that stuff going on in my head that makes me do crazy, destructive things to myself. And I have, sometimes I make better choices now.
Thank you, Deborah. Mm-hmm. Does anybody else have a question? If you're on Zoom, feel free to just go ahead and unmute yourself when you have a question as well. Who else has a question? Kevin. Believe it or not.
Hi, everybody. My name is Kevin. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Kevin.
And Deborah, thank you very much. It's these first three steps, you've been able to tie those all together very well with your own experience, strength, and hope. And although it wasn't done perfectly by your description, I think that all of us feel the same way, that one way or another we're not doing this thing right. And like you said, this is the foundation of a spiritual program. So we all come in with our doubts and fears and things like that. So when you're working with somebody and they have those usual doubts and fears, and like you expressed, you know, the world just wasn't doing it right the way you wanted them to do that. And I think that's almost the universal with all of us. When you're working with somebody, how do you kind of break that down for them? And other than, like you shared what was told by me and other people, it's going to be all right.
It's going to work out.
It's going to work out. And it's just not a very believable statement.
Yeah, and you just feel like nobody's listening.
Yeah.
Crazy old timers. That's, well, you know, I mean, really, and not to, I think for me, I know for me, the slogans, the longer I've gotten sober, the more I use them. I use them more, even the Serenity Prayer. You know, the Serenity Prayer, let go and let God, you know. There's just no explanation for most things. Stop trying to figure it out. It doesn't matter anyway. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Who cares? So that's pretty much it for me.
Who's next with a question?
Quiet in Zoom land. I think it's
anyone?
A wrap.
That might be it. Thank you, Deborah.
Thank you, everybody, for coming back.